sort of doing different kinds of educational events this year, and one thing we thought we'd do is get back to a good old-fashioned evening class, evening discussion, which used to be the mainstay of the movement and adult education for socialism and for social change and all the rest of it. We thought we'd have a go at some evening classes, but firstly, just a warm welcome to Danny Dorling, who's very kindly offered to lead off this discussion this evening. When the president of GFTU and myself were having a word with Danny a while ago, we came up with the idea of trying through education events like this to get a wider and deeper understanding of the new world order that we face. Those of us who grew up in the movement in the 70s faced a very different Britain, where practically everyone was active in a union. 80% of workers were covered by collective bargaining. The gap between the rich and the poor was too wide, but not as bad as now. And there were strange things in those days called public services and a free national health service and all the rest of it. So the world's changed, and we thought it might be an opportunity to think through some of the changes that have taken place to enable a slightly younger generation in the movement to take the thing forward and to fight and think about the world in new ways.
My main point to try to get over is the 1% don't always get away with it. They very often don't get away with it that much. In much of the rich world, the 1% are getting away with far less than they're getting away with here. And they also often at different times don't get away with it as much. It's incredibly easy to get very, very depressed at the moment in the UK. And the most important thing, I think, to know is that the UK is going through remarkable times, different from other countries. So when you began in the 1970s, although you said the gap was too big and it was not great, there was only one other large country in Europe where the gap between rich and poor was less, and that was Sweden. The UK was the second most equal country in Europe in the early 1970s, and it's now the most unequal. So the UK has done the most remarkable thing, the most remarkable change. And I think it's in the light of that that you have this kind of lack of energy and what is possible. It all feels terrible. But it's important to realise how quickly things can alter, and also how people look back at periods. I've just done a load of words there. I think it's really interesting to see how we don't tend to look back at progressive movements in the past and criticise them. Whereas everybody who was individualistic or nasty in the past is generally now seen as individualistic and nasty. Nobody celebrates a rich, powerful group from the past as some wonderful body. Well, you could come up, if you want to win a book, you can suggest one that is seen as particularly good. As you're thinking, it does, seeing what you teach, you probably can beat me. It was currently looked at as what a wonderful group of people they were. There's this kind of a history to it. You all know this, so let's not do any preaching to converted about things. But so many things are so much more efficient, almost market efficient, when you have greater equality. The NHS, it's been independently audited, is the most efficient, best value for money health system in the rich world, despite what's happened to it so far. Despite the 2012 Act, it's still the best. It's going to take quite some more knocking to actually get it to be the second or third best. That knocking is planned for. That's an attempt to privatise it, but it's still very efficient. As soon as you get big inequalities, you get huge inefficiencies. I mean, one example is books. When people, you haven't interrupted yet, there are two big books, one little. I'm going to get you to interrupt. I'm not taking these.
I am going to interrupt in a minute. Yeah. I work for Unison. I was out on the picket line yesterday morning.
Yeah.
And you said healthcare works better when delivered greater quality. There was very little, few people on that picket line. And yeah, certainly, you know, I was a member of staff there, and I was definitely the youngest member on that picket line.
Yeah.
People understand that, but people don't understand that actually, how do we deliver? How how can we deliver greater equality?
How can we get there? Right. Do you want the book with lots of words or the book with less words? It's your choice. Pass them both over and you pick which one you want because you've gone first. They've kind of forgotten. There's a terrible forgetting about all of this. So it was dead easy in my parents' age. Because my parents could remember when you had to pay for the doctor. And when the doctors were particularly greedy. And there's been this forgetting of it now. So that when somebody suggests charging £10 for a visit to a doctor, they aren't immediately shot down.
I'm always disheartened. I've got cousins who lived in Ireland for a bit. In Ireland, you have to pay €50 to see the doctor. My cousin's child has got asthma, chronic asthma and allergies, and you have to pay every time you see the doctor. Every time you've got a prescription, you've got to pay. So not quite kind of, the amounts of years gone by, but still a marked difference to their life in the UK.
Yeah.
She now works for the NHS, but her and her husband, despite much kind of chastising them, would probably vote Tory and would probably think, actually, we'll look after ourselves, we can afford it now, it's okay, why should we put into a system for others?
Yeah.
And it's...
You've had this shift, and we only have the NHS because we created it at a time when we had been becoming much more equal for 30 years. So it's a legacy system of a better society. That's why we've got it. We couldn't create it now. We're not in the business now of doing much that's that imaginative. But it is still by far the cheapest system in the rich world. Which means we can afford to have a big arms industry and the rest of it, which countries that have a more normal health system in Europe are actually spending far more on their health, and it's less efficient to do it. I mean, the book thing was, when you've all got a similar amount of money, you buy a book when you want to read a book. You don't buy lots of books to put in a shelf like that because they'll look nice. But if you want a book, you can afford and actually get one. When you get wide inequalities, people who want a book can't afford to buy one, and a few people with lots of money buy books to put in their sitting room to look like they're clever. And it's just inefficient, all kinds of things. But the reason I'm going on about it is, if you use the language of efficiency, that is a way of attacking people who claim that inequality is good and it's good for the market, using their own rhetoric. But you're right that we've lost a lot of the ethos and the trust and the idea that we can expect people to do a good job because they think they ought to do a good job. It takes an enormous amount to get to that position. I mean, nurses and midwives and doctors in the past worked hard because they were extremely aware of what happened if they didn't work hard. If you didn't do that extra call at night, somebody would suffer. If you didn't, work for an extra half hour past when you're supposed to be working, somebody would suffer. People have kind of been taught to become more selfish now, and so you see it, and particularly amongst the higher paid medical staff, partly because they will have come from families that are richer. Because to get 4 A's, which is what you now need often to get into medical school, half of all the A's at A-level go to kids from private schools. So you're much more likely to come from that background.
I'm sorry, I don't know.
Yeah, you're going to get another book.
Yeah, no, another book, it's fine. Yeah. Just give me one, I'll read one at a time.
Okay, cool.
My sister's 18, she's at university, went to state school, etc. Yeah. And actually, she's driven at the moment by getting a job that pays well. So her selfish need is about... getting a job that pays well, because she's coming out with a hell of a lot of debt.
Yeah.
So actually, I think even the people who are down, have come from regular backgrounds.
Yeah.
But my dad's a labourer, my mum's my mum works in administration, so very, very regular backgrounds, are still driven by a selfish need within university, if they get there, because they've got this humongous debt that they've got to pay off. and it's weighing on her shoulder, and it's their debt, not the collective's debt. It's their debt.
It's theirs, and it's been given, yet.
Which is why it was done. Margaret Thatcher's great quote, she said at the point, the method was economics, but the aim was to change the soul.
Yeah, and she and those men around her, large numbers of whom are actually going to be named in that paedophile dossier. I mean, already Sir Keith Joseph and Rhodes Boyson have been named in the Daily Mail as being in the dossier. It's amazing how many of them were there, but they succeeded. I mean, the central message, there is no such thing as society, there is only you and your family, has won. So the middle class have been told that you're your own little welfare state. You could try to look after your siblings or your mum and dad. Right across the country, you've got middle class families where granny and granddad are sitting in a house that's too big for them. 5-bedroom houses. They often, even though they're middle class, they can't afford to heat it. And they say they'd rather be in something smaller. But for the good of their family, they're hanging on that house for as long as possible so it rises in value, so they can pass on a deposit so their children or grandchildren might not have to rent for their whole lives. And once you are your own little welfare state, the inefficiencies are massive. You end up using housing really inefficiently. But you also just can't insure your family against shocks. But people, they're driven to this because they're not being offered any other alternative. The very young, so the 16, 17, 18, 19, 20-year-olds, people tend to be optimistic. Human beings tend to be optimistic and to think that good things will happen to them and it'll be great, and particularly the young. They tend to be more optimistic in more unequal countries, like the USA is the most get-up-and-go society. We're pretty get-up-and-go. Much less in Scandinavia and Japan. The question that people ask around the world is, are you a better driver than average? Are you better looking than average? These better than average questions are wonderful. Almost everywhere, over 50% of the population say they're better than average at most things, which shows you the general human optimism. But in Japan and Germany, it's only just over. Whereas in the USA, it's 80 or 90% of people say they're a better person than an average person. What then happens to your sister or friend is when they're 21, 22 and 23, it doesn't quite work out. They get something but not on what they want. They might even get what they want, get that starter job in a career, but if they look around the office, they'll notice that there's hardly anybody the tier above them in their 40s or 50s. There's only one or two people there, and often it's a man. But they think they'll be the one that will get through. They fail to get it, and then they blame themselves because they are not good enough. That's the message. If you don't get it, if you just try harder. Okay, well, this is me later. But it's not just your sister. This is the same for undergraduates in the most prestigious universities. It's all. And in a way, it's even harder for them because they've never failed at anything. And so the first time they fail, it's really embarrassing. They're a disappointment to their family, and it's often internalised.
But isn't that society? Isn't that how society is? That's been formed, so if you are from these prestigious sort of places, you will succeed. You don't see failure at all.
There were failures hidden. I mean, there was massive failure from these prestigious places, but it's very much hidden. So it's not talked about. It's also far easier to fail now. If you take Oxford and Cambridge, which take about 1% of all children in the country, almost all those children would end up in the best 10% of careers in the past. Now, those careers are not seen as good enough because the salaries are actually going down for 9 out of 10 of them. So they're trying to get in the 1%. The majority of Oxford and Cambridge students are going to fail to get into the 1%. And so suddenly you've got a situation where even they aren't going to manage it. The number of careers that will get you a salary of over £100,000, it has to be law and only certain law practices in London. It has to be finance or management. Even going into medicine will get you on the edge of that. But it won't. Go on.
But surely that's like set out by everybody else who's before you in your like family history, like whether you go to private school, the area you come from, and you have and you've got no control over that as an individual. Like,
oh, you've got no control of, yeah, you've got no control of your family, where you come from. You've got even less control of the year in which you were born, which is, you know, incredibly different. My granddad was born in 1916. Okay, and that determined his life. He was born in 1916. So for almost all his life, he watched society become more equal and better, and incredible changes occur. But it was because he was born in 1916. And a lot of people of his generation got angry enough because of mass unemployment and the crash and made it better. Go on.
I wanted to say two things. First of all, as a recent undergraduate who failed to get a job and sit with GSA, please get out of my head. Yeah. But I also wanted to say as well, because something I've noticed, I mean, maybe I'm being overly cynical, but I definitely tend to be overly cynical, but I'm also a youth worker back in London, and I work a lot with young people, and I also have a seven-year-old brother and sister at home. Yeah. And as much as I can't really remember my child, I'd like to try and see if I can compare their development in, or even it's just through things like the media, because I watch a lot of the TV that they watch simply just because I'm interested to see what's going through their head, and to see, because, you know, they spend most of their time in front of the TV, and of course the young people that I work with, I'm interested to see how they interact with others in society and how they generally value themselves. And I've noticed something. I mean, I don't know if it could be said the same, because I'm 24, so I don't know if it could be said the same for when I was younger, but at least I can say for those that are slightly younger than me, and especially for my brother and sister, I've noticed that the way they value themselves now is no longer based on careers. It's no longer based about where they are in society. They value themselves based on the items that they own. I've noticed that quite a lot now. I've sort of tried to chat their development through my brother and sister. I've looked at what they watch, and I'm not having a go at the advertising industry whatsoever. I mean, I personally don't like adverts, because I think they're stupid, but they were obviously, well, that's where they make money and stuff like that. But I look at the adverts that my brother and sister watch, and I've noticed that my sister, even though she's 7 years old, she's still quite bad at spelling and reading. But if you play pretty much any sort of toy commercial on What's the Weather, she'll be able to sing it absolutely word for word. Yeah. My mum absolutely hates taking them shopping now, because every single time there's always something they have to have. And it's not that they want it, they have to have it. Because if they don't have it, then other people are going to have it, then other kids in their school are going to have it. Like, you should see the argument that my brother had over the new Skylanders game. You saw the tantrum that he threw because other people in his class were playing that game. My mum couldn't afford it. To him, the value and measure of what he was whether he could have that game or not. And then it filters through. So I look at some of the young people I work with as a youth worker, and the value and measure of who they are is the trainers on their feet. Yeah. It's whether they have an iPod or not. And it seems to me that there seems to be a sort of a greed or selfishness that's being taught to young people, even from a very early age, instilled in their heads. It's almost sort of teaching them that you need to have a large amount of money, you need to have these things to be worthwhile, and if you're not, then you fail.
That's what you end up with. I mean, it's Skylanders team for the Xbox One, 50 quid for Margos, right? And that's what people are. It's the Christmas game for boys of 7, 8, 9 this Christmas. There's always one. For slightly older, it was Nintendo DS. And this is crippling majority of families, buying these must-have items. We spend twice as much on advertising than the rest of Europe does per head. So it's one thing. Go on.
I mean, just to return to the education, I think in many ways, I think you'd probably agree with this, that we find ourselves as a certain generation of people. I was born in 1989, sort of caught between the cracks, and that when we come to graduate and we can't get jobs, it's not just that we can't get these amazing graduate jobs that apparently we're all supposed to be able to get. We can't get, you know, jobs at local government. Sort of the only things left to us are these sort of zero-hour contracts. And our parents' generation, it doesn't quite figure in their head that it's as crappy as it is in the job market.
They don't get it, although you're better off than the generation born in 1965, who entered the workforce in 1980, had it worse than you, in that they hit mass unemployment. Their parents couldn't understand it at all, thought they were being shirking, and so you saw a rise in suicides in young men, which we haven't seen yet. You're stuck in the cracks and waiting, but had you been born 4 years later, you would have a much bigger, you would have paid £9,000 a year. So there's a very angry group who are born September 1993 onwards. They're not, because they're only, haven't even left university yet. But you're the oldest member of a cohort about to come through that's going to be absolutely shafted. And the question is, it's going to be really hard for them to continue to blame themselves as they can't get any secure job, as they can't get decent housing, as if they manage to get a job that pays half decently well, they're going to have to pay £150,000 back on their student loan.
Just a quick side note before we move on. It's quite interesting comparing notes about different year groups that we teach. And like the first, it seems the first year of people with £9,000 fees were a lot angrier than people are now. I mean, I think it's sunk in. And it's interesting to hear about sort of access to higher education and how that's been affected. So I teach a lot of Johnnies and Ollies and Freddies.
There's lots of Johnnies and Ollies and Freddies in all schools, I think.
Yeah.
And, well, to be honest, a lot of the schools that we're working with, we have really high immigrant populations, and they have the sort of, you know, they sort of see that route into profession through university, and they don't, you know, they're coming from family, you know, they don't know any different in this country, so it's slightly... They've got different outlook.
And immigrant families, by definition, always have aspiration and push.
Absolutely.
much more than average, which is partly why London schools have done so well.
Absolutely.
It's just that some kids are being beaten.
Quite regularly in our organisation.
Go on.
Yeah, I'll just add to that why aren't students angry enough point. I mean, I can't speak for all students, but I can speak for myself and most of the people that I graduated with. I only graduated earlier this year. And to me, it's really annoying. In fact, it's made me very angry only since, because when I was at university, I didn't really care that much. I didn't really even click in my mind that I was paying £3,000 a year and I was having all this maintenance loan as well. It didn't click at all. It wasn't until that I got rejected from job after job after job, have to keep going to the job centre to sign on, then being told, why am I applying for this job as the amount of jobs they try to put me in, it's, let's not get into that. But I would say also, I think something that's off with uni, it wasn't until I clicked on the repayment thing on the student loans company where I could actually see how much I owed, which is £35,000. But I then got incredibly angry at the fact that I just wasted 5 years of my life for a piece of paper which so far has done absolutely nothing except, according to the job centre, made me really, really good at trying to apply for jobs at cleaning toilets.
Yeah.
But maybe the union started sending those links around because everyone can access it, but same thing with my friends as well, they didn't start getting angry until they looked at how much actually
the debt was. Go on. Oh, we've got to hand out more. You've won a book.
Yeah.
You've talked to them, you pass that on.
I'm going to reiterate my sister. She's really fortunate. She's gotten into Warwick University. She's put a hell of a lot of pressure on herself to go there. She started university exactly 10 years after I have. I came out of university with £12,000 worth of debt. Because of low interest rates, I've got actually my student loan statement in my bag, so it happened to come through the post not long ago. Actually, I've paid off a whopping great chunk of that £12,000, and I've calculated I should have it gone within 7 years, and I'm paying £100-something off a month. I've tried to explain it to her in that kind of way. You may not get a job. When you do get a job, you will be paying £150 plus, for the rest of your life. And you will never reach that 1%. You'll definitely never reach the 1%. You'll definitely never, get that decent job. The huge chunk of it is probably going to go out in debt.
Yeah, because what a lot of students don't realise is that there are a small group of students whose parents are paying the 9,000. They have no debt. Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, I suppose it's so easy to fall along the line of going to university, like the fact that the government pay 9,000 a year, and so many people, like, from my experience, don't necessarily have a passion for what they're learning about, and they're doing it because it's like expected of them from society rather than because that's what they want to do with their life.
How old are you, just
15.
Just to be aware, that dad might worry about this. You still have the right, although not if we vote a particular way in 2 years' time, to go anywhere in Europe to university, much of which is free. You've got to pay the air flights and so on. It's just amazing how few people from England have taken up, including Crete, if I was going to go for anywhere. But anyway.
Yeah, actually, a friend of mine's taken up. I was telling Stefano, his daughter went off to Holland.
Yeah, but let me just I'll come back to you in a minute. That picture there, the little one at the bottom, was taken in 1936. And it's a very famous picture that appears on lots of books. And the point of it is that the two lads from the public school are looking worried and the working class kids looking more confident, and it's about a time of change. That's when my granddad was aged 20, when almost nobody went to university. I mean, you know, it was, and when the vast majority of people were going to schools that were turning them into labourers and they were told they were never good enough. So lots of, we forget that lots of things have got much, much better. But his generation then had this common experience. He actually had to give his brother his bike so his brother could find a job, because you did have to have a bike to get to work. They had this common experience, and then the common experience of the war. Half of all young women go to university in Britain, so they're all going to have these debts. Okay, it's only about 35-40% of young men go, but it's no longer a posh thing going to university. This generation is going to have a common experience of being screwed. It's not the same as fighting in a war. It's not the same as watching people die and having to get on with people from a different social class, but it is a common experience which is going to make a generation different from yours because you can pay yours off, different from mine because we were the very last tail end of getting something, although it wasn't enough to live off, it wasn't a debt. So there's a chance for solidarity amongst generations again. If people can only understand it is not their fault.
Sorry, I don't mean to keep interrupting that whole university thing, but I just want to know how angry you think people are going to be when they realise that a bachelor's degree isn't enough anymore. Because I've been applying for quite a lot of jobs, and these are basic jobs like paying £17,000-£19,000 a year that are now saying you must have an MA, in the same way it used to be a BA, you now must have an MA in order to be eligible for the life.
And it gets worse. And after you get an MA, you then... That's going to increase. You must pay for an internship. So there are MAs in journalism where essentially you're paying £15,000 for the MA, so that the journalism MA places you in a newspaper and they pay the newspaper for you to work there. This is quite brutal and fairly recent in just how bad it's got. That's worth. Let me click forward a bit. Let's do some of these. Let's forget her. In the past, when we did have this huge increase in equality, it was helped by some people who were very posh. I mean, it's worth saying. It's partly because they were very scared about the Russian Revolution. I mean, that helped concentrate minds at the top. But that's the picture of Keynes. Oswald Foulkes, who was a banker, talked about what Keynes did. It wasn't his theory so much. It was changing what was seen as decent. There was a change in the 20s and 30s about ideas of decency and how you should behave to other people. And greed wasn't good and becoming extremely rich wasn't something to be impressed by. And we still got to begin to get there again. So we're seeing the edge of it with Mr. Dyson. I mean, when everybody talks about wealth creators, you eventually say, name me one. And eventually they say Dyson. That's all, okay?
As if he
ships his production, he's tax dodging on the wealth. But it's only a vacuum cleaner. I mean, this is the other, you know, we managed to make vacuum cleaners in various ways before without having to give one person or family so much money to make a vacuum. It's not a spaceship, it's a vacuum cleaner. But we still are in this, oh, you know, what an amazingly clever person because he's worked out a different way of making.
And we've, what's happened to our Cadbury's? Birmingham was built on great capitalists who kind of, you know, if you take Birmingham where we're sitting today, likes of George Cadbury, likes of Joseph Chamberlain, they innovated in these cities here that we live in. These were rich people.
They're rich people, and they did later on in their lives. When they began, they weren't necessarily that nice in the 1870s, 1880s, and 1890s, when they were setting up their chocolate factories, when they were starting to do it. There was then a kind of panic in the 1890s about just how bad things were getting. So the one I know is the Roundtrees in York. Daddy Roundtree, Joseph, let his son Benjamin spend all his time doing social surveys. So Benjamin did the survey of York in 1899, published a book in 1901 about poverty in York and just how bad it was. There was a vested interest. He had a household budget then, like the minimum income standard, of what you needed to be able to afford, how much food, rent and so on. And it included an allowance of chocolate every week. Because part of their concern was that the workers couldn't afford to buy their chocolate. But the book that came out in 1901...
They're still...
They still did.
They're still putting in a lot more than they probably ever got out. And why don't people?
Well, it's this change that.
How can we do it again?
The world was out of control. So Seaborne Roundtree's book, Lloyd George waved it at public meetings of 5,000 people, got a landslide, began to get pensions and the beginnings of insurance. And there were these members of the elite who, and Roundtree carried on working in this, they created the Roundtree Foundation, which was supposed to destroy itself within 100 years. Yeah, the whole point of it was not allowed to give money for soup kitchens because they wanted to get rid of soup kitchens, which we did. I mean, they're back now, but we'd actually got rid of them. We have fewer nice philanthropists in this country than anywhere else in Europe. You will not find a rich person who says there's a problem with the rich publicly in this country. You can find a few in America. But something very odd about us.
Go on. So, could part of the problem be the reason why we don't have many of these rich philanthropists anymore is because the entire way that society divides itself has changed? It used to be that you used to have a very small middle class and even very much, much, much smaller, like smaller than today, a wealthy elite. Mm. So these people are making products that simply would be sold to a few people and nothing else. They realise they had to pay their workers a lot more because they need to create their own market in order to sell their products. But now we have a very large middle class and an abundant market. So why would, random company A care if its cleaners were paid the living wage? As far as they're concerned, that would only be increasing their market share by less than a percentage point.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter who they pay anymore because they know there'll be people in China, country, United States who they're always to sell their products to. So now philanthropy doesn't pay for itself anymore.
Yeah, or don't feel a loyalty to a particular place. I mean, the other important thing is this curve here. That the white line is the best off 1% of the 1%. And way back in 1910, they were getting 400 times the average income. The top were really incredibly rich. And it's got worse again, but we're nowhere back at that for the very, very top. So one reason the Cadburys and the Roundtrees and the rest of them were able to do this is they actually had so much money. I've got a slight obsession with the very richest families in Britain. And then they're not yet as rich as the very richest families were 100 years ago, partly because Britain was the richest place on the planet. So you've had, you know, that partly says it could get worse, but it also says it was different. There was also people simply not realising how things could be. So my favourite Orwell quote, when for the first time in his life in Barcelona, people looked him in the eye, and you can see it again of people not looking, you worry about it as soon as you say look in the eye and you start doing it. As a society becomes more unequal, you stop looking people in the eye and seeing other people as like you, and then it becomes easier not to worry too much or to think it's inevitable, and we're kind of heading back to that. It's really interesting what you said about attitudes and generations, because yesterday we were looking at a British Social Attitude Survey from the 1980s through to 2012, and we could look at it by every single year of age, 18, 19, 20-year-olds, and what they thought about some key issues. And there's a generation, which is my age group, where we did care a bit and so on, and we got it from our parents. And then you do see this mass young generation who've become really individualistic. And then there's a little bit of hope in 2011, 2012 of 18, 19, 20-year-olds who are a bit angrier in the BSA, but it's kind of clutching at straws to hope it continues.
What can we, as trade unionists here, do? What do you think we could do in order to be able to try and foster some greater activism within our young members?
Well, there's really simple. We forget the really simple stuff, which is so many people, including left-wing academics in my university on temporary contracts, don't realise the personal selfish benefit to them of actually just belonging to a union. In terms of when somebody's trying to push them off their contract or bully them out of work. It sounds trivial, but just pointing out that when you're more likely to get sacked and bullied and so on, the subs are actually worth it. And one problem is people are not joining unions because of the actual cost of belonging to a union. So there's a really simple thing. Union membership ought to rise as precariousness increases, as people are being sacked in FE colleges, it makes much more sense to be a member of a union, just selfishly, just if you're not interested in society, but just for yourself, it's worth it. Even if somebody helps make sure you get the redundancy payment, rather than not get one. It probably sounds annoying, but I have so many conversations with people, and at the end saying, you do belong to the union. And they say, no. And these people are left of Labour, and not necessarily that young. But they were saving money, because money's tight.
That's the same thing. If you go for a strike action, then it can cost you far more than the wage you'd get for a lost day's pay in local government.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's one problem without having inflation. So in the 70s, with decent inflation, if you went on strike and you got the pay rise, within a year, the pay rise would pay you back for taking 2 days off work. Now, if we go on strike, we're going to win our 1% claim. And it's not going to... It's actually... So you're talking about going on strike to try to teach the employers a lesson not to do it again, but it's not actually going to make you much... But, I wish unions would...
Had a pay rise in the last 8 years. Can I just say, what 1% pay rise? Yes.
Yeah.
8 years of strike. Actually.
But the NHS strike is about a 1% pay rise. But what trade unions could do is look wider. So if we could have a policy in this country of saying that our cost of housing is too high, it's the highest cost in Europe, our house prices are too high, our rent's too high, so when house prices eventually begin to come down or crash, we don't want to get them up again, we want them to slowly move down to the average level in the Netherlands or Germany. If house costs can be pushed down by a government, it's like every single trade union winning every single dispute every time. If you reduce people's housing costs by 1%, 2%, 3%, and that people who own a house will lose out, but landlords, you know, we don't care about landlords that much. Go on.
Yeah. I was just going to say, the other problem seems to me that a political one, that all the unions take their lead from, and are almost all of them are affiliated to the Labour Party. And if the Labour Party adopts an entirely neoliberal agenda, in which it is only going to pursue that individualism, it's going to continue essentially those liberal policies, become in a direct line from Thatcher.
Yeah.
Then people are going to be dispirited by that.
Yeah.
Nothing else.
There is
an alternative voice coming forward and saying this is how another world could be.
Just one point of fact, though, for me, not all unions are affiliated to the Labour Party. There's about 15, and there's about 64, 67 trade unions.
But even ones that are, Francis, what's her name?
Francis O'Grady.
Francis O'Grady. Difference between Francis O'Grady and Ed Miliband? Ed went to Oxford as a student. Francis served as a servant on tables, right? She has a slightly different attitude to Ed Miliband because of a different background. But we are in a complete mess with our political parties.
I intend to agree that we're in a complete mess with political parties, but equally as well, the relationship between, obviously, my trade union, I don't know what it is like at the top, but I'm just saying from a regional level, and the Labour Party is such that actually the Labour Party are supporting, pay rises for the NHS, they're supporting not privatising the NHS. So in many ways, they're almost kind of over a barrel with having to make some type of compromises in order to protect their members. And maybe it's about trade unions looking wider rather than looking at their own individual needs. But obviously we're kind of somehow constrained by our own democracy as well, if we have to do that.
Yeah.
Cool. Regardless of whether you support or do not support the Labour Party, I'm not going to put a statement on either one, but I'm just saying that isn't 2015 going to be the year of the protest party? I mean, you all know about UKIP, I can't stand UKIP, obviously, look at me, but we've also got the SNP, we've got the Green Party as well. I mean, this is 2015 is the rise of the protest party, and maybe I'm being overly optimistic, because you said maybe young people generally tend to be overly optimistic. But 2015 is a rise of the protest party, then 2020 will definitely be the year of the protest party. So maybe that's somewhere we can step in there, because it's obvious that it used to be, I used to work in Westminster, and if you went to anyone that's in politics isn't working, they'd laugh at you. They say everyone loves politicians. Oh, we're so great, we're so amazing. I'm not making the hard part, that's verbatim. But you go to most people in the street now, you know, regardless if they vote Labour, Conservative, UKIP, whatever, you ask them, is mainstream politics working? No. You know, politics is now some of the lowest rated career. I can't remember. Yeah. All time. So why can't we step in there?
Well, lots of people are. I know at least 3 people starting parties at the moment. It's never been. And I mean, if any of you want to stand, I'm not a member of any party. I should say at this point, I'm not a member of any party, and I vote for at least 3. But if any of you want to stand for the NHS party in Oxford West, just let me know. They're desperate for somebody. And it's a marginal, it's a Tory Liberal marginal. You wouldn't be damaging the Labour candidate.
Yeah. NHS membership. That's what I would say.
The reason they need a candidate in Oxford West is the sitting Conservative MP is the daughter of a private surgeon. She says she's the daughter of a surgeon. She doesn't say he only treats people with money in Oxfordshire. And if you had an NHS party candidate on the hustings, it would help the Labour. Yeah. But we can't get... there's a whole lot of people my age and older involved in this, but for various reasons, none of them actually want to stand. But they're actually, there's a mechanism for somebody who wants to stand. But there's lots of this going on.
I mean, thinking about Orwell, what strikes me is that there's no grand narrative for the left. There's no idea, there's no vision. I think that's certainly true of the Labour Party, which I'm a member of. But, I mean, if you think about Orwell and even though there were different currents, competing currents, there was still the idea of that, you know, building this better society. Whereas I think, you know, post-79, you know, classic social democracy failed. The Soviet Union failed. Trotskyism never really got off the ground. You know, where are we going? What vision?
I'd agree. But in the 20s and 30s, when most of the hard work was done, people would have then said there's no great narrative, and they'd said, and look at the Labour Party in the 20s and 30s. We're absolute despair. But under the surface, people were writing things, changing things, and altering opinion, but enough so that pay at the top stopped rising after 1926. Pay at the bottom actually came up. Half the gain in equality to 1978 occurred by 1939. You know, absolutely crystallised by the war and then banged in, but the hard work was done in the 20s and 30s, and it was a time when nobody felt things were going right. And it was also, you know, 5 years after a crash. I mean, and there are amazing things going on. These figures, the rise in landlords' wealth, this is now out of date by year. In the last year, landlords have seen their net worth go up by 106 billion, which is not in. Landlords have more. I think 2/3 of the entire wealth of British landlords has been earned since the year 2000 by increasing rents because they can, and then by, with some of the rent money, buying more and more property. So you go to London and Oxford, it's landlords who are buying up the houses. If you can show you've got an income of 25,000. You can get a buy-to-let mortgage with no regulation whatsoever. So you get this huge transfer of wealth and money while the country's getting poorer to a small group of people. And this is unprecedented. A quarter of all families with kids are now in private renting. It was 10% just 6 or 7 years ago. And aren't all those families with kids going to blame themselves that they're in private renting and the landlords are moving them on when they can get somebody to pay a higher rent? Or are they going to begin to get angrier? And it's so recent. Well, I'll just give you one more that's really recent. Credit Suisse, who look at the world's wealth, last year said the richest 1% in the world had 41% of all the wealth. About a month ago, they released this year's figures, and it was 48%. So it's a 7% increase take of the entire world's wealth in 1 year. 7 more years of that, and they have everything. So you can tell that now is really, really unusual, unstable. It's not safe. Even if you were sitting there and you were the most racist conservative who believed that you had special genes and everybody else was a subhuman troglodyte who was put on earth to serve you, you ought to be scared. It's only the stupidity of people at the very top, some, who don't see how unstable it is. People like the chief economist of the Bank of England, Andy Haldane, do. You know, he goes around the world giving speeches saying it's really unstable. And it's, you know...
Are people taking notice, do you think, of that, though? Or do you think it's not yet, and certainly not by May, not going to have filtered down to us here?
No, it doesn't filter down to people, and for the very, very rich, they just try to have a little bolt hole all over the world, of which London is bolt hole number one. So when there's a property crash in China, which has just begun, you'd have thought the Chinese would have learnt that property can crash. Nope. They come in even higher numbers to buy in London, stoking up the chances of a property crash. Go on.
But to say that it does filter down in certain ways. I mean, regardless of whether we would be able to blame the riots on the high amounts of inequality, though, but it does show, I mean, maybe not the United Kingdom, but, I mean, the plenty of reason for everything that's going on in the Arab Spring, for everything that's going on in Africa and Middle East right now. But a lot of it is due to the fact that you've got a very large population of young people who are unemployed, have a medium to high amount of education, so they understand what's going on. And also they do generally tend to be male as well. But it's for those reasons why, well, they've seen what's happening and they're either standing around in squares the mile their governments go, or they're picking up guns and, well, taking it for themselves in one way or another.
Lots of things are very... My view of capitalism is it's a temporary thing. It's a change from one state of being to another. And, okay, it's 400 years, but it's actually a transition. It's not a steady system. We hit peak baby in the world in 1990. So we had the most babies we've ever had in 1990. It's been going down since. So which means that we're now at peak 24-year-old. Well, the deaths are actually high enough, so slightly if you've been nerdy about it. But essentially, we're at peak 20-year-old in the world. The world's never had more 20-year-olds in it. So, you know, this is a strange time, but just give you one other. Europe's never had fewer young people, because Europe, population decline began in the 1960s, right? So never produced fewer babies. Europe's never had fewer under 25-year-olds, and we've got 25 million out of work. I mean, it's an incomplete mess to have so few young people in Europe, so highly educated, and so few jobs for them. It's incredibly unstable and unsafe, and you can't predict what's going to happen year by year by year by year. And we have a tendency to sort of think we can, and we forget that the banking crash was a shock and nobody really predicted it. But it just is not stable. But the things which are stable is the houses aren't going to fall down. You know, we're very unlikely to get a major earthquake in this country. There are other things that you can... If we manage to have thousands of people homeless, it's our own doing. It's not from natural disasters.
I was just going to say that, I mean, one of the things that just in recent, you know, recent memories is the Scottish Independence campaign. I mean, you suddenly saw, from one of the people I've talked to who were up there, you suddenly saw when there was an opportunity, something looked like you might be able to make a difference, i.e. by voting to get, you know, taking it out from the elite, wherever, to get away from the UK. When that looked like a possibility, everybody was talking. Got told. Everybody was talking about politics.
Yeah.
Everywhere. Young, old, you know, every street, everywhere. Because it was a possibility of something, I don't even remember, I think it was a trap myself, but because it looked like there was a possibility of something.
Yeah. And it really was. They switched from... It began as a kind of patriotism thing, and then inequality became the main thing of the debate. It's only 5.5% of voters needed to vote a different way, and it would have gone, yes. I was in Glasgow for about 3 days before it, and then Glasgow was majority. And the question I kept on asking people was, how many people do you now know that you can name that you've met and talked to? And people's actual social circles, and they could name check other Scots who were involved in this. I think what would have happened, my friends who won the Yes campaign said there is no money, if we win we're really stuffed. I think it would have actually been in the short term worse than that. I think there would have immediately been a run on the pound. The British banking system would have collapsed. It would have brought on a crisis very, very quickly. Because... Yeah, what is it that's holding...
It's a nice way to have had this huge change that you seemingly alluded to might be necessary.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit old and boring over the way... I'll show you in a minute. This is France and the UK, just to show the difference, but then how weird we are. Let's go forward to... There's Germany and Japan. The really fast way to get a more equal society is to lose a war. That's That's how they've done it.
They've also got a very good relationship with their trade unions. I know, obviously, working,
Oh yeah, in Germany now, but they had a very bad relationship with their trade unions before in the 30s. Yeah.
Essentially, trying to do the absolute opposite of everything that happened before.
Yeah, and it's another reason why they keep the housing cost low is because they can remember hyperinflation. In Japan, which is the more impressive line, the Americans took the land off the aristocracy and redistributed it across Japan. Yeah. It's the most brilliant natural experiment in what happens if you take the world's most unequal country, which Japan was with a feudal system, and make it the most equal country overnight, which they did to try to prevent revolution. That was their fear. And you end up with the longest lived, healthiest people, lowest crime rate in the world, and a 90% middle class, which is a 90% working class. It's the same. It's not all perfect in Japan, but the problem is if you're... Big radical change tends to happen through disaster more than revolution, but at least be prepared for disaster and have a plan for how to deal with it, which just involves people need to be housed, they need food, they need work, they need something to do, but there is a very good chance that people in this country might have a lot less to live off in future than they currently have. And if the rhetoric's all about how can we get growth again, it might just hit a brick wall of something that does happen, because
do you think we need to change the rhetoric away from growth and towards equality maybe get a different type of engagement from people who are currently engaged?
Equality and very, very basic social security. So very basic is not being homeless, not being hungry. I can't get the Labour Party to pledge that within 5 years there will be no need for food banks. It's a really simple pledge. Having a job with some respect and some choice of it, but not necessarily a well-paid job, just a job with respect.
But a
sort of very simple, if you go back to that pledge card that Labour had in 97, a much more basic set of pledges over a safety net that is actually, it's really realistic, even in very hard times. And this is seen as defeatist, it's seen as not aspirational. What I don't know is how you sell things like this as it actually would be better than what we'd otherwise get. And the other thing I don't know, I think we've lost. In the past, the left would suggest or do things which were new. So they'd suggest that we have GPs. Well, I suggest we have GPs. Then they suggested that we have these doctors working in surgeries together. And then they got it. They suggested the NHS and got it. They suggested council houses instead of slums and got them. And they suggested comprehensive schools and got them. The left no longer suggests new things. It tries to defend the things that its grandfathers created in the past. And it just sounds very unaspirational. It's very hard to, in a country that's done so badly, to think how could we be better. But the left isn't offering what it used to offer, which was hope, new progress. A kid like me couldn't become a professor nowadays because I wouldn't have been allowed through. In the same way as if I'd been born 20 years earlier, I would have failed the 11 plus. I mean, I learned to read when I was 8. So there was... The 70s weren't utopia, but there was this one moment in time when you went to the nearest school, things were getting better, and the health service workers genuinely believed in the model. They actually did. And we lost it, and we did have it, and we've forgotten it.
Do you think, in some ways, Thatcher and her greed is good, and her individualism, has actually, if we could have someone else like that to change it around, it might do that?
Yeah, and it takes time. Thatcher and her friends, and it wasn't just Thatcher, I trace it back, you can see it, there was two elections in 1974. In the second election in October 1974, the southeast of the country swung to Tories in a big way. Not enough to win it, but millions of people actually swung to the Tories. That's a year before she became leader. So the southeast of England kind of decided to get selfish early. And part of the reason, I think, is the country as a whole was becoming relatively poorer. This had been the richest country on earth. We had one great thing Orwell said about 45 is we don't realise how relatively easy it was when you had so much money coming in from colonies to set up a welfare state and so on. As we lost the colonies, we lost all that dodgy money and so on, we became poorer, and for the home counties it was almost too much. And all that putting the grape back into Britain again was relatively rich families simply trying to keep what their parents and grandparents had managed to get from owning half the planet. And that's a very strange situation to be in. If you're trying to understand why is it so shit now, it's partly so shit now because we were the empire just a century ago. And it's always hard work becoming normal again.
But I want to talk about this whole notion of equality, because every time people keep on talking about the Scandinavian countries, about how equal they are and about how great it is, things for everyone, I just keep saying, for you, maybe, but I know there are certain places that I can go around and that I can be welcome there simply because of the colour of my skin. So while equality may be moving in the right direction for regular people, especially look what's happening even in our country with some of the recent trends for another very large sector of people, it's moving the complete opposite direction. I mean, you know, some of us were nation-hating terrorists. The others, well, people like me, I'm either a rapist, a mugger, or a thug. I really want to know what to do about this sort of thing. So, like, you look at the employment rate for young black males, it's 1 in 2. That's 50%. It's even higher for young black females. I remember when I raised this point when I was working in Westminster, I got told to a Labour Party colleague, Nolies, that there were not enough black people in the country for anyone to care about that. But we seem to be moving the absolute opposite direction. I mean, yes, the BNP may be nearly dead, but the EDL is still moving strong. We've got Britain First, which I'm surprised that I've got my friends, people that I thought I knew quite well, sharing their stuff and like saying that they support Britain First, despite this is a group that goes around throwing bacon and mosques and stuff like that. And okay, I will say that I'm not as anti-UKIP as, but I mean, I've never voted UKIP, but I'm not as anti-UKIP as most other people. But while the leadership itself may not be as bad as we think we make them out to be, the supporters are definitely a lot worse than we make them out to be. And they're literally, you know, going to UKIP because they see it as a more acceptable face of fascism.
Yeah.
Or fascist, I can't pronounce it.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, things do. If you have a darker skin colour or you've recently moved to this country, I understand that people always turn on those who look differently. They always turn on the outsiders when things are hard. But it's hard for everyone. It's hard for all of us, you know. I just, quite frankly, I want to know essentially what to do, because things seem to be absolutely terrible. I mean, I really hate being facetious. I know it's not a game. I know it's not, you can't compare points on any of these sort of things. But I look at, I was looking at the wage gap. I was doing some research the other day. I was looking at the whole wage gap thing, and I saw that for women, the wage gap was 80%. For black males, it was 74%. And for black females, it was 64%. And no, there seems to be an entire section of society that nobody really seems to care about that much anymore. It's like it's almost as if, right, you've got your laws, we don't do slavery anymore, you've got your lot, now go off and be happy. And if you can't be happy, well then, screw you, we'll just shoot you down, and we'll just get some police officers to shoot you down the street corner every now and then.
But those differences in pay gap are only possible if you've got wide pay gaps. In countries with narrower pay gaps, you still get racism. Black people in Scandinavia are at the bottom, but the bottom's much higher up. Doesn't mean things. I mean, one really interesting thing about Britain, and this is partly because of having an empire, so London's a real big apple, not New York, is that Britain has had less successful far-right parties than most of Europe, even though most of Europe is more equal. But that's the legacy of empire. And I'm going to have to go and get a train, but you're going to do the last one because you've been funny.
I was going to say, did we lose it or did we bottle it? Did we get complacent? Did the trade union movement back off? Just going back to the initial discussion about philanthropy, is it philanthropy or do capitalists just do enough to get by? So, you know, philanthropists aren't investing because they don't need to, because they've still got a stable society.
Yeah. They put money in, so you had the Mayfair Club, the Adam Smith Institute. The old families of Britain chucked money in the 70s in a last-ditched attempt. What's funny is they didn't actually manage to save themselves because they've been replaced by people who've come in from abroad. If you look at the rich list now, the first 60 people aren't the old families who are paying the money to protect their status. And if you look at the dukes and the aristocracy, they've kind of crumbled. But there was this rearguard fight in the 70s because they were facing their children becoming normal. and having to mix with other children, and you know, and that was scary for them. You're going to get a book. You're getting a book.
Okay.
Share it,
Danny. Because of the breakup of the nationalised railway network, Danny's got to leave us now. So let's give Danny a big thanks for participating.